Welcome tonight to the day after Cinco de Mayo, which was a celebratory time for Mexican freedom while many around the Western world remain in unfree states. The last few, there are more free states in the United States, not only those states that never shut down, but also those states that are freeing up, though not fully or completely, while many parts of the country remain completely shut down for day 30, day 40, day 50, day 60, depending on where you are in the world. Tonight resolved, the shutdown is killing more lives than it saves. That is happening in two different ways. First, in the indirect collateral consequences of the shutdown, in terms of lack of access to medical care, in terms of panic-induced people not seeking timely medical care, in terms of the starvation risks that it posed, in terms of the suicide increases that it creates, in terms of the social isolation life expectancy costs that have already been calculated to be as long as 10 years for at least 3% of the population, far more devastating than the virus could ever be or will ever be in this instance. But putting aside all of those collateral consequences, including increased crime in certain places, spikes in domestic violence, spikes in child abuse, spikes in other related homicides and death from such severe social isolation, we have, in addition to that, increasing evidence of deaths from the shutdown. Not only deaths increased because we locked people up into nursing homes and crowded them onto subway train cars in ways that were counterproductive, but there's more and more evidence that staying inside and forcing people to stay inside at risk of being arrested or cited or fined or punished. If you go out for a morning swim, you could get thrown down as the police have done. If you go out for a paddleboard, you could be surrounded by police as has happened. If you go out surfing, there are some countries that they're actually shooting at surfers that were simply trying to be out there. If you go for a morning stroll on the beach, you can be arrested. If you go through a jog through your park, you can be arrested or fined or punished. In addition, we've seen it, people that are not social distancing outside, according to some New York police officers' dictates, can lead you to being punched and thrown to the ground. In the same context, we've told people and forced people and locked them up. And increasing evidence, of course, that like most influenza-type viruses, this virus kills most lethally and most effectively when you lock people inside. Indeed, let's look at chart number 4, which is a quote from a prominent study previously done. And what that quote says is the outdoors, exercise, sunshine, and fresh air are all good for people's immune systems and health and not so great for viruses. There is a compelling link between exercise and a strong immune system. Equally, a lack of vitamin D, which our bodies synthesize when our skin is exposed to the sun, has long been associated with increased susceptibility to respiratory diseases. In other words, the lack of access to the sun, lack of vitamin D, increases susceptibility to respiratory diseases like influenza-type infections, which is what COVID-19 is. The outdoors and sunshine are such strong factors in fighting viral infections that a 2009 study of the extraordinary success of outdoor hospitals during the 1918 Spanish flu suggested that during the next pandemic, we should encourage the public to spend as much time outdoors as possible as a public health measure. Yet our politicians have done precisely the opposite. You get threatened, fined, cited, punished, arrested if you go outdoors. You're forced to stay indoors. Exactly the opposite of what the medical literature was saying going into this virus. If we look at chart number 5 in a study of the SARS virus, which like this is correlated to a form of coronavirus, it noted that the most important means of spread of the virus has been from human to human in settings that involve close interactions between the infected and uninfected, such as hospitals and other indoor facilities, facilitating droplet and contact transmission. Most of the people in whom SARS developed were household contacts of SARS cases or were infected in indoor hospitals. Outside of those settings, with the exception of a very few unusual circumstances, SARS was not found to be highly infectious. If we look at quote number from chart number 6, as a German virologist studying this COVID-19 said, quote, there is no significant risk of catching the disease when you go shopping. Severe outbreaks of the infection were always a result of people being closer together over a longer period of time, such as sending COVID-19 patients back into hot nursing homes and closing the doors and locking up the windows. That's a good way to spread the virus. That's a good way to kill people. But that's what our politicians were doing. In the same context, if we look at chart number 7, which is tracking this virus, what they found was that home outbreaks were the dominant category. Almost 80% of all spread of the virus came from home contact, followed by transport such as subway cars. Most home outbreaks involve 3 to 5 cases. They could only identify a single outbreak, just one, in any outdoor environment, which involved just 2 cases. All identified outbreaks of 3 or more cases occurred in an indoor environment. That's why the article is titled Indoor Transmission of COVID-19. Indeed, if we look at another quote from a prominent medical literature publication prior to this virus, in chart number 8, we'll see one of the what has been sort of axiomatic logic in dealing with influenzas prior to COVID-19. During the winter, and ask yourself, why is the flu called the seasonal flu? Well, during the winter, people spend more time indoors with the windows sealed, so they are more likely to breathe the same air as someone who has the flu and thus contract the virus. If we look, in other words, the best way to spread this virus, force people to stay indoors. Best way to spread this virus, keep people from going outdoors. And that is exactly what our politicians have done. That is exactly what our politicians have recommended. That is precisely what Bill Gates, his backed institutions with their models, told people to do. They said the only way to curb the spread of this virus is to do exactly the opposite of what has been all of the recommendations of medical literature for more than a century plus. So this virus is not only killing people indirectly, over 130 million put at the edge of extreme starvation around the world, spikes in suicides, spikes in drug overdoses, spikes in alcoholism, spikes in child abuse, spikes in a wide range of deaths that come with extreme social isolation, projections of a lost decade of life expectancy for up to 3%, which is, by the way, the equivalent of 10 million Americans are going to lose 10 years of life expectancy as just a collateral consequence of this shutdown. But this shutdown is causing death directly. That's why more than half of the deaths are coming from nursing homes where COVID-19 patients who had been tested positive for COVID-19 were sent back into the nursing homes, required to go there, and then they locked the doors, closed up the windows, and forced them to stay in a perfect petri dish for the spread of this disease to the most vulnerable population that could get this disease. This shutdown is killing people. And frankly, from the evidence, it's almost as if it was deliberate, almost as if it was intentional, given the known medical literature. At a minimum, it was grossly reckless conduct. Now, of course, the scientist responsible for this at Imperial College in the United Kingdom had to leave his job because he himself ignored the shutdown order to have an affair with another married woman. Meanwhile, of course, the University of Washington-based institute is still pushing out fear porn and fear propaganda on a regular basis, as it did yesterday. People that made recommendations that was against the recommendations of medical literature, against the past policies of dealing with pandemics, particularly flu-driven, influenza-oriented, airborne pandemics like this one is. And what we have seen is an increase in death disproportionate to shutdown countries and shutdown states. Indeed, there is increasing evidence that the shutdown areas are experiencing higher lethality rates, higher spread rates than areas that did not shut down. And maybe that's because they've been forcing people indoors rather than letting them out, rather than encouraging them to be out. Indeed, that is why the seasonal flu is seasonal. It's because in the heat and the humidity, it doesn't survive. And when people are outdoors, it has a greater difficulty transmitting and spreading. So this virus is killing people not nearly as much as it would have done but for the politicians forcing people indoors to spread it worse and kill people more. Whatever their agenda or objective may be, whoever may be behind this politically, the consequences have been deadly to millions of people around the world. Indeed, we should remember that we've been through flus before, we've been through pandemics before, and we've never responded in the way we are responding now. As one of those quotes mentioned, in the Spanish flu, outdoor hospitals were the key to reducing the spread of the transmission and the effect of it, and the lethal effect of it and impact of it. In the same context, it's useful to remember that we had the Hong Kong flu in 1958. The Asian flu in 1958, the Hong Kong flu in 1968. In both cases, they killed five times as many people as a typical flu season did during that time period. And yet we didn't shut down anything. You know how many businesses were shut down? None. You know how many civil rights or constitutional liberties were suspended? None. So why is it that we adopted such an extreme policy that was ahistorical, that was contrary to the known evidence from the medical literature? Was it some other objective than protecting our public health? Indeed, as this article mentions, the South China Morning Post, how Hong Kong flu struck 50 years ago and claimed over a million lives worldwide, over 100,000 in the United States, but we didn't respond this way at all. And ultimately, the contagion did, like most of these kind of viruses, petered out on its own accord. In addition, we have more evidence of the collateral consequences of the mortality rate. As this headline records from the Daily Wire, dozens dead after lockdown measures delayed their heart surgeries. Health official, certainly wasn't intended. What did you think was going to happen when you shut down medical capacity? What did you think was going to happen when you told doctors to go home? What did you think was going to happen when you banned elective procedures? Elective procedures just means they're not emergency procedures, not that they're not needed procedures. In fact, people with needing chemotherapy treatment have not been getting it. People that suffer from a wide range of serious medical ailments and illnesses have not been seeking timely care. This is just one study of one example where dozens died because of the shutdown, not because of the virus. Indeed, as Florida Governor Ron DeSantis mentioned in reopening Florida, quote, we have flattened the curve despite false predictions. He points out that even though they shut down much later and reopened much earlier than most of the rest of the country, they experienced less lethal consequences than did those cities, counties, and states that shut down earlier and continue it to this day. Indeed, as a former Supreme Court Justice of the United Kingdom has written in the Daily Mail, locking up the elderly until coronavirus is defeated is a cruel mockery of basic human values. He issued a withering critique in the Daily Mail, going through how it not only deprived us of our civil liberties, but denied us our quality of life. And as it turns out, of course, it also impacted our quantity of life, as it is in fact killing more people than it is saving. It is useful in that context to reference again the article published in the medical literature. Full lockdown policies in Western European countries have no evident impacts on reducing the spread of COVID-19. Indeed, if you go, he went through it one by one by one, looking at all of the available data, looking at the timing and chronology of that data. And what he found was consistent that indeed there was no positive impact that could be found from any of the evidence for this lockdown policies across the Western world. Indeed, there's another article written today and yesterday that, in fact, published today. Are the CDC's coronavirus statistics fraudulent in accounting and legal analysis? And the paper goes through how the data is being calculated and classified and categorized in a manner contrary and counter to the traditional metrics used for measuring influenza-like viruses. That's why you see these people say, well, I don't know anyone who's died of the flu, but I do know people have died from COVID. That's only because of how the health officials have reclassified COVID. Typically, when they die of COVID, they don't die of COVID specifically. They die of some medical condition that they attribute or allocate to COVID-19. But when it's studied or reviewed in any meaningful detail, it's increasingly questioned whether, in fact, COVID-19 had even any causative relationship to the mortality and how much it actually impacted life expectancy. Using certain legal and accounting standards, using the measurements and health metrics that have traditionally been applied, would likely find that the mortality rate for COVID-19, if flu statistics were used, are substantially less than the numbers that we are being told. In that same context, Alex Berenson went on Fox News and Tucker Carlson and talked about how this basically only impacts people that are severely ill or severely elderly already, people who are over the average life, the average mortality rate impacts people over the age of 80, and mentions that there's someone with severe morbidity condition. This actually shocked some people in the press. They thought this couldn't be true. They were going to expose this as fake news. Clearly Fox was spreading something that was insane. That's how badly informed our own journalists and press are. They believe their own propaganda that they're pushing out to the world so badly that they don't know basic elementary facts that have been confirmed across the medical landscape. As this article from the Daily Mail notes, 99% of patients killed by coronavirus in Italy had existing illnesses, study found. Indeed, research into the deaths found that less than 1% were healthy people with no other serious illness. Nearly half of them already had three or more comorbidity conditions. In other words, this is someone who's 81 plus years of old, age. So they're over 80. And on average, they had three or more serious deathly diseases. And then they want to say, oh, COVID-19 is what killed him. The reason why President Trump doesn't know of anybody who died from the flu is because that hasn't been listed as a cause, even when people believed it may have had a triggering impact in the medical literature. And we've completely recategorized and reclassified COVID in a completely unique way, because these are people that had severe deathly diseases, on average over 80, with at least three other deathly diseases. And they just decided to call COVID the culprit. By contrast, we had contrary evidence from the inception, as an Israeli professor showed that the virus followed a fixed pattern that, regardless of the mitigation measurements taken, tended to spike up, then tended to flatline with an S-curve, and then drop precipitously. All the data keep showing that happening again and again and again all across the Western world. The places that are experiencing the worst spike, those that have done the most intense shutdowns. Of note, it is especially older people who are dying with COVID-19. As study after study, the Office of National Statistics in the United Kingdom broke down who was dying, and they discovered that even though people over 85 are only 2% of their population, they constituted almost half of the people who are listed as dying from COVID-19. That even though people over 65 were less than 20% of their local population, they constituted more than 93% of those who had died from the virus. And of note, again, these are people on average with multiple comorbid conditions. By contrast, more and more people are recognizing that this go inside approach is deadly, and that prohibiting people from going outside is equally deadly. And so we have an article from the Globe and Mail. It is time for a new mantra. Go outside. Maybe don't congregate too closely, but go outside. Noting that, in fact, that's what all the medical literature has supported. That is what the medical literature continues to support, and that is what the experiment of COVID-19 continues to show. Indeed, another article in the same context, along the same vein. Let people go outside. As most public health experts actually questioned, say going outside outweighs the risk of being inside. So that's what you're seeing from the people that are somehow being excluded from the public policy debate and dialogue in America. Indeed, why is it that someone like Alex Berenson, a former New York Times columnist, can't get an interview on CNN? Anderson Cooper can interview someone he dislikes, like the mayor of Las Vegas, who may not be the most informed on this subject. He could, if he wanted to, have an honest discussion and debate and dialogue, as we have had repeatedly on this show. But instead, he won't invite anybody on the show that has knowledge and can capably provide contrarian information, even someone who's not a Trump supporter and is not a partisan like Alex Berenson. Indeed, as Yinon Weiss talked about back in April, and it's increasingly true, visualizing the state-by-state shutdown on effectiveness went through how, in fact, the statewide stay-at-home measures had no material, meaningful impact in reducing the transmission of the disease. As another article from the same from Lyman Stone articulates, lockdowns don't work, going through all of the problems they've created without any evident manifest benefits. Meanwhile, if you go back to the office, what this virus appears to be really being used for, this pandemic increasingly is a 9/11 style pretext for a massive power shift in our civil society and our public economy. Welcome back to the office. And this is a Wall Street Journal piece Your every move will be watched. Employers plan on new tools to measure office interaction and track workers' health. It's only a matter of time before they're talking about body scores. They're talking about using track and tracing on their phone. It's only a matter of time before they say, well, the best way to really track you is if we just put a little chip in your arm. Meanwhile, people are increasingly noted that instead of flattening the curve, we flattened hospitals, doctors, and the entire United States health system. As talked about in this article by in the Federalist, across the country, hospitals shut down. Now, all quote-unquote non-essential, non-COVID effectively, procedures in preparation for a surge of COVID patients that never appeared and never occurred. So in this doom and gloom picture of this devastating virus precipitated a set of solutions proposed by the same group of dubious modelers ended up collapsing the quality of American medical care for millions of people and is going to be and is increasingly documented as having caused deaths in city, county, and state across the country. They'll then use those excess deaths, of course, to say that they must have been COVID deaths and we must have even more deaths than expected. If that's the case, why does Sweden have one of the lowest rates of excess fatalities during this time period, while countries that shut down have a excess mortality rate on average three times higher than those countries? Indeed, if we look at the actual COVID-19 epidemic curve, we can see its rapid decline in area after area after area around the world as various statistics increasingly document with the data. Indeed, we should remember that Imperial College in the United Kingdom has decade-long history of exaggerating pandemic risk. As was pointed out by the BBC years after they made their material mistakes, mass culling for foot and mouth disease, this is where they basically burned out some fields and killed a bunch of cattle in the United Kingdom, fearing a widespread foot and mouth disease, turned out to actually be completely counterproductive and utterly unuseful. But again, this ends up being told years after the fact and buried by the institutional press, relying upon the same doom and gloomers who usually have an ulterior political motive at work. Increasingly, of course, people are noting that the federal government, the Fed's programs are buying up state, city, county, municipal debt as they go further into debt due to these shutdowns, and they were already in financially precarious position before them. How big will these federal programs get? No one knows. Indeed, the Fed is talking about tripling its balance sheet to over $10 trillion by year's end, and the Fed may increasingly be the primary creditor of your local government. Additionally, of course, more mayors are recognizing and more public officials are recognizing the collateral consequences of these shutdowns. Mayor Kane of Knoxville questions the lockdown after utterly shocking suicide spike in his local community. That's what happens when you socially isolate people and strip them of their job and deny them their everyday purpose. Meanwhile, the few governors that have been willing to stand up to this, Governor Kristi Noem of South Dakota, has been subject to routine and ruthless public attack from the press. As this article details, the media attacked Governor Kristi Noem for not panicking and destroying her state. The South Dakota governor rejected the mandatory government force shutdown. Now the media claim her decisions were made out of emotion and naked ambition. Indeed, you notice that, in fact, everyone else that has taken a non-shutdown action or recommended a non-shutdown action, like the Bakersfield doctors, have their personal motives questioned and critiqued, while those who are pushing and propagandizing this shutdown are just simply noble servants of the public interest. Indeed, as is determined in Pennsylvania recently, more than 80% of new COVID deaths in Pennsylvania are occurring in nursing homes, as detailed yesterday in the Elwood City Ledger. Why is that happening? It's happening because we've locked up people with COVID-19 amongst each other, amongst the most vulnerable, told them they can't go inside and have to stay inside. We created a hotspot for deaths to occur because of these public policies. Meanwhile, of course, there's more and more data as reported in that new data suggests the coronavirus isn't as deadly as we thought. This is based on the serology surveys that are being increasingly confirmed and affirmed across the country and across the world. As the American Institute for Economic Research details, we can't trust governments to manage a pandemic. Indeed, if there's any lesson from this pandemic, it's that the policy response shows how untrustworthy our public officials and especially our public health officials are. And this real life Milgram experiment. We were the ones that ended up getting shot repeatedly. Meanwhile, when we talk about the potential source of the food of this particular virus outbreak, it's useful to remember that all that panic from the foot and mouth disease we talked about earlier that led them to kill a bunch of cattle unnecessarily, as they determined years later, because they were wrong about the model and wrong about the solutions, the same Imperial College that promoted the fear porn this time. Well, by the way, they determined back then that UK labs were actually suspected as the source of the outbreak. So keep that in mind, that there's this history of bioweapon experimentation that ends up leaking out in one way, shape, or form, deliberately or accidentally, that ends up causing a pandemic risk, that ends up causing panic in response to the pandemic, that ends up causing public policy responses that appear to be more protectual about shifting power than it is protecting public health. There's a history of it. But, of course, be careful what you post on Twitter. As Breitbart notes, Twitter will now warn you if you're about to post wrong thing. So just in case you're about to post something you're not supposed to that might be offensive or upsetting to someone, they're going to warn you now that you're about to encroach into dangerous territory. By contrast, of course, Sweden continues to experience much better positive results from its results. As this detailed article in The Spectator goes into, Sweden tames its R number without lockdown. The R number is the rate of replication of the virus by transmission. And it was supposed to be the case, according to all the models, that the only way you could reduce this is to do something that was not only ahistorical, but counter-historical, by locking people in rather than letting them out. And it turns out Sweden decided, let's keep people out, and they are experiencing one of the better results in response to this, even though that wasn't their original intention. Their original intention was, in fact, just to deal with a higher spike in deaths now to reduce the total amount of deaths over time, without causing collateral consequences of the collapse of the medical system and the collapse of the public economy and the suspension of civil liberties and the deprivation of quality of life. It turned out they achieved both, because the shutdown has led to more deaths rather than less, more spread of the disease rather than less, based on the data that we're currently seeing. Meanwhile, as the New York Times would like you to know, social distancing informants have their eyes on you. Largely confined to their homes and worried about the spread of the virus, members of the public are increasingly becoming unofficial watchdogs. What nice phrase for rats. What nice a phrase for your neighbor spying on you, friends and family members spying on you. Indeed, to give you an idea of how bad it is, let's take a look at a little footage from inside a 7-Eleven just yesterday in Austin, Texas, from video clip number 15.
Fuck you.
So here's what's happened. Someone just walked in, and literally the person working decided to take a bat and was threatening to beat the person with a bat because they weren't wearing a mask. That's right. So this was in Austin, one of the more quote-unquote open states. You have people working at the 7-Eleven, not themselves wearing a mask, that if you walk in and you don't have a mask, they may come bring a bat to your head. That's the situation and scenario we live in today. When we come back after the break, we'll be talking about someone who helps veterans. Many veterans are increasingly at risk of the various forms of mental health care that should be present or not there. Economic support structures are not there. Just like churches, a lot of charities are suffering across the country. And we'll be talking to her about what's happening in her worldview and what is taking place in this collateral consequences that are truly deadly from this shutdown. The panic response to the pandemic is killing people every day. If we're to make a difference, if we are to change things, we must continue to push back politically, legally, and by every means possible. So come back after the break, and we'll have more with her and more about the rest of it. Welcome back to American Countdown, as we continue to see a countdown to increasing loss of civil liberties across the globe, including in particular the United States, as we see the shutdown killing people more than it saves lives, as we see it killing the economy, killing the quality of life of millions of people around the world, killing our Constitution in the process. What's been quarantined and what's been killed is our liberty, our economy, and increasingly lives that were unnecessarily lost due to the public policies and the panic from this pandemic. Not the pandemic itself. We have with us Gretchen Smith, who's part of Code of Vets, and glad to have her with us today. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm ready to talk about veterans and how it's impacting our community walking through this COVID pandemic economic shutdown.
And you can follow Gretchen on Twitter at twitter.com/CodeOfVets. Could you describe for people what Code of Vets is and what it's about?
We are a 501c3 veteran nonprofit, and we operate purely on social media platforms to raise awareness about veterans' issues every day. And what we do is we will post individual veterans their crisis, their needs on a daily basis to raise funds. And by doing that, we have the capability of raising these funds quickly because we're reaching across the nation to donors, to Americans, to let them know what our veterans are going through.
Well, you've definitely done great work. How challenging has it been during this shutdown in terms of which has been worse for the veterans that you look after and your organization helps look after? Has it the virus or the shutdown and the policy response to the virus?
The policy in response, this has been overwhelming. I've never seen numbers like this. I want to start off with this by reading one of my posts. And this is serious business, what we're dealing with. What I'm going to read is about a veteran, a Marine, who took his own life on May 1st. Our brother-in-arms committed suicide May 1st. His PTSD, social distancing, COVID pandemic, being out of his normal routine, not seeing his friends, not going out doing public events, keeping him in isolation was too much. Rory Patrick Hamill, he was a corporal in the United States Marine Corps, took his life due to the isolation. And we are seeing this all over the country. This is far and beyond more deadly than the pandemic, than the virus itself.
And can you explain to people that are veterans? I mean, there's some familiarity with PTSD, the effect of it, but I think there's an underappreciation for the relationship between social activities, civil liberties, public economy, and mental health. So there's been studies and surveys that are documenting as many as 10 million Americans are going to lose 10 years of life expectancy on average just due to a two-month shutdown, especially if it continues unmitigated and unabated in large parts of the country. Can you explain how the need to keep a regular routine, the need to continue to socialize, the need to continue to be outdoors, the need to continue to routines for that are maybe personal, like exercise, but also socialization, their job, how it keeps their mental health practicing and working when they suffer from various things like PTSD because of service to our country?
Oh my gosh, we know that this is a fact for all Americans, for human beings in general. We are not made to walk that path alone. We are social creatures. We are supposed to be interacting throughout life. And especially this hits the veteran community in an even more impactful way, in a more deadly way because of the PTSD, the TBI, and some of the other mental health issues that some of our guys and our women struggle with after they come back from combat or their 20 years of service in the military. I can't stress this enough. When you isolate someone with PTSD, it is incredibly damaging. And I was on the phone the other day with a combat vet in West Virginia, was just going off the rails, just said, Gretchen, I can't even go fishing. Fishing is no longer allowed. He could not understand or wrap his mind around something as simple as that. That is something that de-stresses him. It's something he's always done. It's part of his routine. And when you move that routine away from these veterans and you remove them from these social situations where they interact with their brothers and sisters in arms at the VFW, where they go and have a drink, or just when they just get together and just hang out, when they're no longer allowed to do that, you're going to see problems. You're going to see a spike in suicide. You're going to see veterans reaching out saying, I can't do this anymore. And that's what this particular young man, Rory, in his 30s, lost his battle because he was isolated at home and couldn't deal with the added stress of this virus and the quarantine on top of his PTSD. This is truly a crisis in our country. I've never seen anything like what we're dealing with right now.
I mean, no doubt about it. I mean, it's we've never done anything like this in our history, not as a response to a medical policy or procedure or pandemic, not as a legal response. The closest example would be the mass internment of American citizens of Japanese ancestry during World War II. That's the only time we've done anything like this. And here we're doing it to everybody, all 300 million plus Americans, without exception. Has there been, well, to your knowledge, I haven't seen any mayor, governor, anyone issuing these shutdown orders carve out exceptions for people based on either mental health issues, based on economic necessity issues, based on particularly for people like our veterans who are in their position and condition to a large degree because of their willingness to serve the country. Do you know of anyone who's even recognized how this is impacting veterans today?
There has not been any exceptions. And I'm going to tell you, as we dig into, you know, the vet community a little bit more, not only have there not been exceptions, but they are cracking down. If you want to talk about utility companies, mortgage lenders, landlords who are not giving our veterans a break. We are having to make phone calls to landlords and ask for them to remove the late fees. The same thing with utility companies. There was a 60-day moratorium put out by the president and the federal government. But how is that being overseen? Because from our view, we're down here at the grassroots in the weeds with individual veterans dealing with hundreds of veterans per week now, which is unlike anything we've ever seen. And I'm telling you what, people are not abiding by these moratoriums. This is a nightmare. Our veterans are in crisis. Like I cannot express it enough. We have never seen anything like this. And I do not see anybody giving any slack to our warriors who have kept this country safe. We wouldn't even have a nation if it were not for the men and women who serve in our military. And that's what's a disgrace about this. Our mayors, our governors, the utilities companies, the mortgage lenders, you would think that they would be thinking about these veterans who struggled anyway and have rough lives when they come back from war. But not to give them any sort of an exception or any way out or some sort of normalcy, sense of routine is beyond me. This is not humane. This is not the America that I know. And I'm telling, this is not constitutional.
And in that capacity, because I mean, for example, in prison systems, the way they effectively torture a prisoner is to put them in isolation. And that's someone that, I mean, they may have some mental health issues, but not necessarily the scale or scope of what veterans can have to go through and trying to restructure their lives. That now that footing, now that foundation has been ripped away from them in terms of the impact on their mental health. But and there's been no political exception from it from our politicians and looking out for them at all in this capacity. But what you're talking about is the economic side of the equation. So, I assume veterans have lost jobs. I assume veterans don't have the means of economic support. And while that is also going on because they're denied the ability to seek employment, there has been no effort by the creditors, whether it's utility companies, whether it's mortgage servicers, whether it's banks who are getting lots of money from the Fed right now, trillions of dollars going to parts of the financial system, going to big companies, going to big banks. So you're saying that there has been no targeted relief for veterans at all, either on the job side of the equation or on the debt side of the equation.
Yeah, on neither side. We are just seeing unprecedented numbers. Just from May 1st through May 5th, just to give you an idea, we had 557 vets come our way seeking assistance because either one or both paychecks are now gone from the family. They have put in for public assistance through the state that they're in. State systems are overwhelmed. They are not set up to deal with 30 million Americans being unemployed at one time, reaching their hand out saying, I need help. I need EBT. I need HEAP, the TANF, which is cash aid assistance. All of these systems are overwhelmed in every single state, including the unemployment system. So a lot of these veterans coming our way are the ones who've not been filtered through the system yet. They're still waiting in line. And we don't know how long that line's going to be because the numbers, again, are unprecedented. We've never seen anything like this. So we've got veterans that cannot pay basic bills. They cannot feed their children. A lot of them had been living paycheck to paycheck. And if they were fortunate enough to have 30 days of savings, that's now gone. So they are literally living on air beside themselves. I have veterans begging me for food. I have never seen anything like this. And I can't stress this enough. We are operating in emergency mode 24 hours a day. My team is behind the scenes, a team of volunteers trying to process as many veterans we can through our system so that I can push them out into the public eye onto our social media platforms and raise funds for them. There's nothing else we can do. The line is so long, I don't even know if we'll be able to get to them all. All we can do is try.
So you have emergency mental health issues, emergency economic issues, emergency family support issues. To what degree has the shutdown impacted veterans' access to medical care? Because there's large parts of the country where elective procedures were not being done. There's been, or were actually banned or prohibited in certain places. where people have not been able to see their get therapeutic care, have not been able to get rehabilitation care, have not been able to get, in some cases, things like getting chemo for cancer treatments, getting heart treatments, getting basic key needs, timely needs, but because they were labeled elective rather than emergency, have been denied. What's been the impact on the quality of health care available to veterans during this shutdown?
Oh, it's been deadly. It's been drastic. We've been dealing with this again across the country with hundreds of veterans, if not thousands. We had a veteran that we had been advocating for who was told in November that he was terminal. And back then, they should have put in place a palliative care plan, which they did not. And my partner, and she's a professional advocate, was all over the VA trying to get that appointment. And then once Corona hit, everything ceased and stopped. Any kind of care that you're, unless it was emergency care, which I consider palliative hospice care. I mean, you cannot put that off. Our veteran will die before, you know, if you put him to the side, he only has a number of months to live. And so we struggled with that one. That was a very serious one we were working on. And we've got cases across the country that where veterans were not being seen by the VA for, they were not getting their insulin. They were not getting their primary care appointments, being checked on for high blood pressure, for there's so many different issues. Psychiatrists, you know, their mental health was being set to the side. We've got one vet who has missed 26 appointments since February because of COVID, and he is a mess. He has had suicidal ideation for the past year. He has missed all of his psychiatry appointments, all of his therapy appointments, all of his acupuncture appointments because he's got back and spinal injuries. For me, those are not elective type of doctor's appointments. That is something that needs to be maintained, and we need to have a continuity of care. But time and time again, we have seen them shut us down and say, your appointments are canceled. You're going to have to wait until this is over. How are they supposed to survive in the meantime? When they run out of insulin, that's an emergency. We're seeing gaps in insulin and medications that these veterans have to have on a day-to-day basis. So I believe the cure has become worse than the problem itself. We're just dealing with a mess here in our country, and I don't see it getting any better.
And to the degree that veterans participate, I mean, most veterans or many veterans fought for principles, not fought for politicians, so that they risked their lives and risked their limbs and risked their liberty and risked everything about their quality of life in order to protect core principles that define what it means to be an American. And that in particular includes First Amendment freedoms and Second Amendment freedoms and Fourth Amendment freedoms and the rest. To what degree have veterans organized politically or participated in various political protests? And how much have they been the subject of reprisal or criticism or targeted criticism because of their participation in things just like public protest and political activity?
You know, I have talked with quite a few veterans about this, and some of the veterans, because you're seeing pockets of protests throughout the country, and there are veterans there that are representing our community because our freedoms are so important to us. We are oath keepers, and that's why we serve, to protect the Constitution and just to keep our America free. Freedom isn't free, and it came with a heavy price, loss of limb, blood, sweat, and tears, and lives. Some gave the ultimate sacrifice. And to see what's going on in our country, our freedoms are being stomped on, they're being removed, distorted. We've never seen anything like it in America or in the veteran community, and we are all overwhelmed by this. And some of us are ready to stand up and bear arms. I'm just going to tell you, it's getting to the point where you're pushing us into a corner, and we feel like our freedoms are being permanently removed, not temporarily, but some of these things in place are not right. When we all have a sense of what is right and wrong, and what is going on in our country is wrong. And we've been discussing, when is it time? When do we step up and say no more? We're going to rebalance the law and order. We're going to bring back our Constitution, because you cannot make people cower in their homes. You cannot force people not to work and earn paychecks to keep a roof over their head and pay and provide food for their children. These are basic God-given inalienable rights that we as American citizens have. And so we're seeing this being pushed on us, and veterans are tired of it. And yes, there are reprisals for veterans, because veterans are feared, because we're trained. And most of us do, but we support and love the Second Amendment, and we do bear arms, we carry. We're licensed to carry, and we're a threat. But you know what? It's called a state-regulated militia. We have been trained. We're here. We're watching. And I'm telling you why. They cannot push this very much further. I do not want to see blood on this soil. I do not want to see civil unrest. But if we do not get this under control, the governors and the mayors are stepping over the line when it comes to our freedoms and our rights. We're going to see some serious pushback from the veterans and from American citizens in general. We've about had enough.
In that capacity, given the work that Code of Vets does, the critical role it plays in protecting veterans that have emergency issues across the country, and you mentioned that this is at a crisis level, I think one of the most damaging parts of the shutdown is that it deprives people of the financial means to provide charitable and financial support to those they want to. For example, one of the side effects of preventing people economic activity is that we're seeing churches suffer substantial reductions in the ability to support those churches. And my guess is, particularly while Wall Street is being protected, big banks are being protected, the politically protected and politically privileged are being taken care of financially. Those out there, like a lot of small businesses, still never got any of the Paycheck Protection Program. There's been nothing targeting veterans or their particular needs, despite the obligation the country has. How much has a Code of Vets taken a hit or an impact because of people's limited means to provide support to those they want to provide support to, particularly in this time of crisis and need?
Well, you're exactly right. The politicians are making sure that they're protecting the elite and themselves while they're leaving the American people out on the outside looking in. I do have to say for Code of Vets that we recently partnered with Charlie Daniels and his veteran organization. And as a result of that, we've been able to pull in more donations and help more veterans this through the month of April. And we're looking like it's going to be a good month for us in May. But generally speaking, our churches and our nonprofits are suffering because people don't have paychecks. We got 30 million Americans out of work, including my family. My family's suffering. This is the first time that we've been unemployed since we were out of the Air Force. So this is something new for us that we're having to walk with every other single American that's unemployed. So, yeah, the government is definitely not taking care of the veteran community or the nonprofits, but I have to say that thus far, Code of Vets, we've been able to raise, I want to say, $278,000 since April 17th. So that's pretty significant for a grassroots organization in the middle of an emergency.
How much do you think people are waking up? Like, I'm still startled that those who have followed so much of institutional media don't know basic facts about the virus. There's people who still think hospitals were over flooded and over capacity. There's still people, major members of the press today, who are shocked to discover that the average age of death from the virus was 80 or 81. So how much is that reflected in the community that you're in and interacting with? How much are people increasingly awake and alert to the reality of it? How many are still in a sort of dark spot concerning the truth about this?
I do believe the majority of us know that there is an issue here. You cannot justify the numbers of the coronavirus and look at the economy and the impact of 30 million Americans out of work and that ripple effect it has throughout every single American family who no longer has a paycheck. How are we supposed to survive? How are we supposed to live on air? That's not reasonable or rational. Right. So I really believe as time marches on and we're continuing to see more and more veterans go without paychecks, more people are starting to take a hard look at the data. There are still people who are drawn into CNN and the mainstream media and they are believing what they hear. But I'm on Twitter a lot. I'm in social media a lot. That's where I live. That's where I raise funds and help veterans. And I'm starting to see more and more people question this, saying, why is this being dragged on so long? Why have we only seen, 60-some thousand deaths or possibly even 30-some thousand? What's the true number? We don't even know because we can't trust the CDC. We can't trust what those numbers how they're being forced down our throats. I don't believe the numbers. I don't know what they are. But what I do know is how many Americans are unemployed. And I see the impact. And I have civilians and veterans coming to my small organization begging me for food, pleading and crying, and with numbers that we just can't even, you can't sustain these numbers long term. So how is our nation supposed to sustain this? This is absolutely absurd. And I do believe that as time goes on, we're going to see more and more Americans standing up and saying, we cannot stay shut down. We need to open back up as a nation, united, and we need to be smart. We need to have common sense and wash our hands and protect our at-risk family members. But we need to go back to work now.
How much do you think that sort of a veteran's perspective? Because in my experience, a lot of veterans have a good balance of respect for authority figures, but not too much deference to their political agendas or objectives, because they often experience on the ground a very different reality from whatever the purported political plan is, whether it's how Iraq, you know, how the invasion of Iraq's going to go or how Afghanistan's going to go. They have a much more nuanced understanding. They're like experienced DEA officers who understand aspects of the drug war that other people do not in terms of its futility at certain specs and certain aspects regarding it. How much do you think a veteran's perspective has helped inform people's response, that they have that filter of that experience to not always defer to government information and know how to watch what the appropriate metrics are for what is a good or bad policy for the country?
Well, that comes along with military training, and I'm glad you brought this point up. When we're given an order, we look at it and determine, and we have, within sometimes in a split second, we have to determine, is this a lawful order? And that's something I think that's great. And I think a lot of the average Americans, when they are out in social media, especially since we're all at home, they are looking to veterans to kind of lead the way in that area. Should we be supporting our government during this crisis with this virus out there, not knowing what it's going to do to us as a population? Or, you know, or do we need to start pushing back and saying, hey, now these numbers are not looking like, you know, it justifies these extreme measures. Do we need to have measures in place? Yes, but it needs to be balanced. We can take care of public health. At the same time, we can take care of our economy. We don't have to be either or. So I do believe that the veteran community is playing a lead role. I actually am seeing it because I'm looking at Twitter accounts all day, thousands of them, and I'm noticing that they are plugging into what the veterans are having to say. And there's a lot of discussions going on right now. And I'm a veteran myself, and I firmly believe this was an overreach by our government. I do believe the virus is real. I do believe it has taken some of our Americans' lives. But at the same time, we have done more damage, catastrophic damage to our economy than what any of us have ever seen in our lifetime. And it's completely unnecessary, and it was not warranted. And that's where we come in where, you know, we were trained. We are supposed to follow orders, but they have to be lawful orders, and they have to make sense, and they have to be constitutional. So that's a great point that you bring up, that when veterans look at it from a different perspective, I don't get emotional about it, and it's not about Republican or Democrat. This is about the Constitution. Is this in the best interest of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Does this uphold our freedoms and our rights that we are sworn to defend?
Oh, exactly. When we come back, we'll ask one last question about what would be the message to the president if we could get that to the president today. And in addition, we'll wrap this up and talk in further about the pandemic policy response causing panic across the globe, but increasingly causing more harm than it saves in ways that we can measure on a daily basis, and what the cure should be to this disease of panic pandemic policies, not the pandemic itself.
America first.
Welcome back to American Countdown. We encourage you to continue to support the sponsor of this show that makes these platforms available and accessible to the world at a time when YouTube and Google and big media are trying to suppress and censor independent truth in favor of the institutional narrative. You can go to InfoWarsStore.com, where you can buy products that are good for your health, buy products that you simply enjoy, ranging from coffee to supplements to t-shirts and hats, you name it. But that's a critical, important, essential, and fundamental way to continue to keep alive one of the most important independent mechanisms of free press that our First Amendment was institutionalized to try to protect, but that the big tech, big brother world increasingly tries to deny us. So continue to support our sponsor and make shows like this accessible and available to you, because free press and free speech is about free thought. It's the key to making sure independent ideas are expressed and independent ideas are heard so that independent actions can be taken, particularly when we have a crisis of confidence as we are experiencing today from our public health officials pushing us down a pandemic policy that created an infection far worse than the infection it was intended to defeat. In that regard, Gretchen, what would, if you had an opportunity to be eye to eye with the president, what would be your advice to him and your message to him from veterans about what he needs to do moving forward?
My advice would be simple. Let us go back to work. Let us be Americans. Let us be adults. We do not need Big Brother or the government watching over our shoulders every minute of the day. We do not need someone telling us we need to cower or stay in our homes. We are rational. We have common sense. We know that we need to take measures to protect our loved ones who are at risk or who are older. We can wash our hands multiple times a day. We can respect others' personal space. I don't like to call it social distancing. I'm tired of that phrase. But when I do go out, I will respect someone's personal space. But we have to be able to go out as a nation and work as American families and earn that paycheck to put food on the table and to pay our basic bills. Our veterans are suffering right now. There's millions of veterans and Americans who are out of work that no longer have the ability to take care of their family. And I'm talking about basic needs, running water, keeping your lights on, food on the table, and a roof over our heads. Those are the basics, and we have rights as Americans to make sure that we provide that for our family. We need to open America up for business. This is what is going on in our country is completely against the Constitution, and we don't condone it. We, the people, are not on board with being at home, living in fear. I want to live life. I have served my country. My dad, I lost my dad to his battle with PTSD. I am not honoring his life or death or service by staying at home. I want to honor his life and his death by living life, by enjoying my freedoms, and by making my own choices. That's what being American is about. It's a free state.
And Code of Vets has done fantastic work in the past. Where can people, and continues to, where can people find Code of Vets, particularly in this critical time period for veterans where they need help more than ever before, due to our politicians' wayward and rogue set of policies? Where can people find you and find Code of Vets to provide the necessary and critical support that our veterans need?
We have a simple form on codeofvets.com if you are a vet in need. It is a vet in need form. Go find it, fill it out. We will put you in line. We will vet you. We assist honorably discharged veterans. We do have criteria that needs to be met. It's very basic. But again, go fill out that vet in need form. If you want to donate, there is a donate link button. There's never going to be enough funds to cover the millions of veterans that are suffering. But I'm telling you what, we're giving it our best. Find us on social media, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. We do have a LinkedIn account. Check us out, follow us, and support our mission. We have a 1% operational cost. This truly is about veterans taking care of veterans.
So yeah, it's definitely not the Clinton Foundation, which I think had about a 98% operational cost. The Code of Vets has done fantastic work. I've heard good things about what you've been doing for years now. It's more critical than ever before, as some of the people who risk their lives for our freedom are now put at risk by the anti-freedom policies being imposed by governors and mayors across the country. So now is a good time to take action. Highly recommend Code of Vets to participate in it. If you're a veteran who needs assistance yourself, definitely reach out, and people will rally to your defense as you rally to ours. So thanks for being with us tonight, Gretchen.
Thank you, Robert, for having me. Thank you for sharing our mission.
Absolutely. We live in a time period in which those who have risked the most are put at the most at risk now, based on the pandemic policy responses we've been experiencing. But there are some police officers and others who have sort of pushed back. There are sheriffs and police officers that have said they will not go along with this set of policies or procedures. But some of our politicians continue to move forward anyway. We live in a time period, as Tucker Carlson mentions in his recent rant, we live in a time where totalitarianism is increasingly seen as the new normal. Let's take a look at video clip number two.
Last week, we interviewed a longtime partner at the consulting firm McKinsey & Company called Peter Walker. Like so many in finance and consulting, Walker spent an awful lot of his career doing business in China. We have no idea how much money he made doing that. We do know that along the way, Walker internalized a lot of the attitudes of China's totalitarian government. During our interview, we asked Walker what he thought of China's lockdowns. Here's what he said. Now, credible reports suggest that Chinese authorities locked people in their apartments and left them to die. We know they snatched people off the street and threw them into police vans. God knows where they went. That's the quarantine that you think they deserve high praise for. Why?
Well, I think, Tucker, if you just look at the results, okay, so I know there's always going to be questions about exactly what the numbers are, but I think the harsh action that they took, given the scale of China and the number of big cities in it, was exactly what they needed to do to be able to prevent the outbreak from going any further. And the reality is the outbreak hasn't gone much beyond Wuhan.
So the secret police kidnapping citizens off the street, authorities locking people in their apartments from the outside until they starved. Let's just look at the results. All of that, Walker said, was, quote, exactly what they needed to do. This is the view of one of America's most prominent business leaders. He did not seem ashamed to say it. In fact, later in our interview, Walker suggested that American authorities could have done the same things in New York if only they'd gotten an earlier start. Kind of a shame they didn't. Your jaw dropped watching it. But here's the striking thing. Nobody seemed to notice that he said it. Walker didn't find himself on the front page of the New York Times the next morning. No one in American business denounced him. He went home to bed, and that was it. Totalitarianism does not shock us anymore. Maybe that's because all of a sudden, it's all around us. You may have seen this tape already. If not, you've likely seen many more like it in the past few weeks. Two armed officers arrive at a family's home in Wisconsin. Someone has reported the mother to police for arranging a play date for her daughter. That's now a crime. Here's what happened next.
Are you aware that we're in a stay-at-home order right now?
Yeah, obviously.
By the government?
Yes, I am aware.
Okay, you're aware of that?
I am aware.
I don't need to explain that to you.
Why are you here?
Because your daughter is going to play at other people's home and you're allowing it to happen. Stop having your kid go by other people's home.
Are we done here?
No, we're not.
Okay.
Your middle initial and your last name.
I'm not giving it to you. I haven't done anything wrong.
Okay.
Perfect.
We got it.
Yes.
Okay.
And that'll be documented too, that you're uncooperative.
You are uncooperative. That will be documented. Notice the tone they strike with this mother. They are standing on her property, uninvited, hectoring her about the so-called crime of allowing her daughter to play outside the house. They're not apologizing for this. They're not embarrassed to be carrying out an order that has no basis in science. They are utterly self-confident. They treat her with pure contempt like a peasant. And later, the Calumet County Sheriff's Department posted an account of what happened on their Facebook page. In it, they refer to that mother's mobile home six times. Just, you know, she lives in a mobile home. Oh, just a prole. Just a peasant. Shut up and obey. Who cares what she thinks? They believe they have the right to do that. The question is, where exactly do they get that right? That's a good question. It's a question that we are strongly discouraged from asking. The short answer is, governors told them they could. Never in American history have politicians been more powerful than they are now. Effectively, they are gods. In the state of Maine, for example, Governor Janet Mills now has the power to suspend any law she doesn't like. She can seize any state resource she feels like seizing. She can force any citizen or all citizens from their home. She can do all of this for as long as she wants, as long as she believes Maine is in a state of emergency. In fact, there's virtually nothing that Janet Mills can't now do. Many governors now have these powers. J.B. Pritzker is the governor of Illinois. On Monday, Pritzker did his best to explain why his word is now law in the state. It has to be law, he explained. Otherwise, thousands would die.
The stay-at-home order has prevented tens of thousands of illnesses and thousands of deaths. History will remember those who put politics aside to come together to keep people safe. It will also remember those who so blindly devoted to ideology and the pursuit of personal celebrity that they made an enemy of science and of reason.
In three sentences, Governor Pritzker framed himself as a leader of historic stature. Those who doubt his decrees are, quote, enemies of science and reason, enemies of civilization itself, enemies of the state. 2 days later, on Wednesday, this Wednesday, it emerged that Pritzker's own wife, who has her own state employees, was one of these people. His wife apparently had violated the lockdown herself. Governor Pritzker was asked about this. Here's how he responded.
What is your response to people who say the stay-at-home order and non-essential travel bans aren't being abided by your family? I believe there's a report from Illinois Rising Action that says that she recently traveled to Florida.
Well, first of all, I want to say that in politics, it used to be that we kept our families out of it. You know, my official duties have nothing to do with my family. So I'm just not going to answer that question. It's inappropriate. And I find it reprehensible, honestly, that reporter wrote a story about it.
Yeah, how dare someone cover that? Asking about whether or not J.B. Pritzker's own family is obeying the order that your family is morally obligated to follow is, quote, inappropriate. Indeed, the governor says it is reprehensible. How dare you? It would be very useful in moments like this to have an independent media. News organizations exist to hold the powerful to account. Here we have the powerful acting with no accountability at all. And our news media, they are cheering it on, besotted fangirls. No abuse is too grotesque for them. No talking point is too stupid to repeat. Reporters will do whatever they are told. They are all in. MSNBC recently sent a camera crew to document one of the latest and most Orwellian developments in America's descent into Chinese-style social control. Barking drones that harangue citizens from the air. MSNBC was delighted by it.
Please go away from each other and separate.
Elizabeth, New Jersey is now using drones to spread the life-saving message.
You are not immune to this virus.
Move away from each other, commands the state of New Jersey. Break it up! Your God-given right to free assembly has been suspended indefinitely. Back inside, proles, or you will face the consequences. MSNBC applauds this as if it's all completely normal. In fact, it is, they tell us, a life-saving message. Handmaidens to the Corona security state. But to their credit, at least MSNBC put it on television. Most outlets don't even bother to cover stories like this. The other day, prosecutors in New Jersey charged 9 people for daring to participate in a Jewish wedding in their backyard. A few months ago, that would have made the news. For 250 years, Americans have enjoyed the unfettered right to practice their faith as they choose. Now they don't. It happened overnight. Last month, Christians across the country were legally prohibited from celebrating Easter in their own churches. The national media barely noted it. How exactly is this happening? Well, it turns out that's not clear. Strangely, not very many people have asked. Politicians have no right to do any of this. They cannot make it illegal for people to go to religious services. The Constitution of the United States expressly prohibits that. The words could not be clearer. The First Amendment explicitly prevents government from making any law that inhibits the exercise of religious faith. That's not a detail or a footnote. It is a cornerstone of our history and of our legal system. Millions of people, probably your ancestors, fled to this country from around the world precisely because our Bill of Rights gave them this guarantee. It's why this country was founded. And in a moment, it's gone. How? Where did politicians get the authority to do this? Because some elderly, power-drunk epidemiologist told them to do it? That's not how our system works. It can't work that way. Occasionally, you hear someone complain about this. Some lonely civil libertarian will fret that we may be on a slippery slope toward losing our rights. If only. We're already there. We've slid to the bottom of that slope. Our rights are gone. No one has explained how politicians are allowed to do this. Where's the authority come from? How can they override the Constitution? Nobody seems to care. They're too afraid. But if you think this moment is scary, consider what might come next. Now that we've ceded all authority in the country to our political leaders, what can't they do? What are the limits to their power? That's not a theoretical question. It's not an argument over philosophy or political theory. It is the most practical possible question. The answer will define where this country goes next. What can't politicians do in the name of public health? As it stands, politicians won't let people worship or work or go to school or see their aging parents. They place the nation under house arrest. That's happening today, right now. But let's say we all get more afraid. What then? What couldn't they start doing? Could they intern people? Seriously. You can dismiss the possibility of that if you like, but remember that just a few months ago, most of us would have dismissed as ludicrous the possibility that propaganda-spewing drones would be hovering above. Now we have them. So what's next? What can't they do? Let's draw a line at some point.
Indeed, there was a time where we did draw such a line. Not only is this completely unparalleled and unprecedented, but any when certain small examples of it were given, our courts did the right thing and stepped in. Let me read from an article in the American Institute for Economic Research, which published an article called "Why Aren't Americans Suing Their Way Out of Lockdown?" in the hopes that the judicial branch might step in and remedy the situation. They note a decision, their favorite quarantine case from 1856 in the New York Supreme Court called the People versus Peter W. Roth. Roth knowingly and willfully broke a local quarantine regulation, and he was brought up on charges. Judge Lucien Birdseye, a well-known judge in New York and well-named judge in New York, found the entire quarantine problematic. He noted that it, quote, sentences all persons, well or sick, whether exposed to infection or not, to an unlimited imprisonment. Sounds a lot like what was happening or what is happening today across America. As the judge then noted, it can never be permitted that even for the sake of public health, that any local inferior board or tribunal shall repeal statutes, suspend the operation of the Constitution, and infringe on the natural rights of the citizen. As the judge determined, he felt, quote, no hesitation in declaring that the entire quarantine order void. He said disobedience to it constitutes no crime. Indeed, the prisoner must be discharged from his arrest. And yet we now live in a time and place where that is routine and regular to such a degree that we had people like a salon owner in Dallas jailed simply or put under a 7-day sentence simply for operating her hair salon to make sure her employees could feed their families and house their families by getting a paycheck. A police officer also stepped up against this, and we'll show that in just a second. But we should show one of the questions from the Wisconsin Supreme Court, Justice Bradley, a justice I've been in front of before on multiple occasions, one of the great minds of our court system. And she brought up that doesn't this go to the core of constitutional liberty, even mentions and references the case that lives in infamy, Korematsu, that wrongfully approved such extreme actions and reactions by government officials. So let's take a look at the clip of her asking questions yesterday, rarely available because of the nature of the case and things being zoomed and used for video technology. Let's play video clip number 4.
Counsel, as you begin your argument, I'd like to direct your attention to Article 1, Section 1 of the Wisconsin Constitution, which reads in part that all people have certain inherent rights. Among these are liberty. To secure these rights, governments are instituted, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. My question for you is, where in the Constitution did the people of Wisconsin confer authority on a single unelected cabinet secretary to compel almost 6 million people to stay at home and close their businesses and face imprisonment if they don't comply, with no input from the legislature, without the consent of the people? Isn't it the very definition of tyranny for one person to order people to be imprisoned for going to work, among other ordinarily lawful activities? Where does the Constitution say that's permissible, counsel?
Indeed, indeed, indeed. Justice Bradley, one of the great bright minds of our Wisconsin court system. I went to law school there in Wisconsin. One of the great judges and justices anywhere in the country, putting the question as blatantly and correctly as can be phrased. What gives any one individual such power of tyranny over 6 million citizens in the state of Wisconsin? What gives any governor, whether Governor Grusom or Mayor de Stasio or Mayor Beetlejuice from Chicago, any such power or authority to exercise such unconstitutional restrictions on our core fundamental liberties? particularly that come at such cost and consequence to some of the very people, such as our veterans, that we heard from earlier in the show. Indeed, there are some police officers increasingly questioning whether the orders they're being given by their superiors are lawful orders, are the right orders. Let's take a look at video clip number 6.
You know, as a police officer, I'm compelled to make this video. I've been in law enforcement for 10 years, and I'm speaking to my peers, other fellow officers, people in any kind of law enforcement position. I've seen officers nationwide enforcing tyrannical orders against the people, and I'm hoping it's the minority of officers, but I'm not sure anymore, because every time I turn on the television, every time I look to the internet, I'm seeing people arrested or cited for going to church, for traveling on the roadways, for going surfing, opening their businesses, going to the park with their families, or doing nails out of their own house, using their own house as a place of business, and having undercover agents go there and arrest them and charge them with what? With a crime? I don't know what crime people are committing by doing nails in their own house, but we're seeing this more and more and more, and we need to start looking at ourselves as officers and thinking, is what I'm doing right? Now, I want to remind you that regardless of where you stand on the coronavirus, we don't have the authority to do those things to people just because a mayor or a governor tells you otherwise. I don't care if it's your sergeant or your chief of police. We don't get to violate people's constitutional rights because somebody in our chain of command tells us otherwise. It's not how this country works. Those are de facto arrests. You know, we're violating people's rights and taking money from them, or even worse, arresting them and depriving them of their freedom when they are exercising their constitutional rights. So let's talk about that. Let's read something right here off of the Declaration of Independence. All men are created equal. Among these, we have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their power from the consent of the governed, meaning our power and any government official's power is derived from the people, okay? We don't hold power over our citizens. It's contradictory to everything that our country stands for. And this is what I'm seeing. First Amendment rights, telling people they can't go to church, freedom of religion, okay? Telling people they can't protest, freedom of assembly. Fourth Amendment violations, illegal traffic stops to check for papers. What are you, the Gestapo? Is this 1930s, Nazi Germany? You don't get to stop people unless you have reasonable suspicion or probable cause that they have committed a crime. And I know people that have personally been stopped saying, we want to see papers showing that you're essential.
David, you copy a phone call.
That is not how our job works, okay? What really has been pissing me off lately is the fact that these officers that are going out here and enforcing these tyrannical orders, what they're doing is they're making my job and my safety, or they're putting my job and my safety at risk. Because what you're doing is you're widening the gap between public trust and law enforcement officers. And what that's going to do is it's going to, I mean, look what's happened to law enforcement in the last 10 years. Less and less public trust, and more often than not, that is a result of isolated incidents that get blown out of proportion. Well, they're not isolated anymore. They're happening every single day. And the thing that I want you guys to realize is that our power that we hold as law enforcement officers is nothing more than a facade. It's a badge and a gun. And people you don't realize, if you haven't lived in anarchy, if you haven't seen combat, things can be stripped from people in a heartbeat. And that's what I'm afraid of. I'm afraid that these actions are going to wake a sleeping giant, i.e. the American people, okay? They are going to be put in a position where they won't have their rights trampled anymore. And us as law enforcement officers, we'll have our ability to enforce the law stripped from us in about 10 minutes, okay? I think what is going to happen if this continues is we're going to see bloodshed in the streets, okay? I don't want to see bloodshed in the streets on either side of this coin. I don't want to see fellow officers get injured or killed, and I certainly don't want to see citizens get injured or killed. And I promise you, most of you out there doing these tyrannical acts against our citizens, you're not ready for combat. You're not mentally or physically ready for combat in the first place. I promise you, you don't want to go through that, and I hope I never have to go through that again. You know, you don't get to just say, well, I'm doing this because I was told to do so, or I'm following orders, or I need to keep this job. Guess what? I need to keep this job more than anybody. I have 3 young children. I have 2 houses. Like, I have the same sob story that the rest of you guys have. But my personal choices and my living arrangements, no matter what they are, don't allow me to trample on people's rights. And I don't understand why that concept is so hard for people to understand. Listen, you need to stand up for what's right. You need to, if you're part of a department or an agency that is asking people or asking their officers or their deputies to impose on people's rights and infringe on their freedoms, you need to step up and say, no, that's not me. That's not what I signed up for. And that's going against my oath. And if that costs you your job, so be it. At least you'll be able to look at yourself in the mirror at night. I've already expressed this to my department. And luckily for me, I come from a department that I feel like my chain of command shares my view, but I don't care what department you're part of or what your chain of command thinks. You don't get to trample on people's liberty.
Exactly. You don't get to trample on people's civil liberty. Inalienable rights. That's what the Declaration of Independence says. That means inalienable, not capable of being separated. Arrest. That's what detention of people in their houses without freedom of movement is. When we come back after the break, we'll take your calls. But we need more people like him willing to take a stand to keep the Constitution alive in America. Welcome back to American Countdown. We'll be taking your calls, the jury, in this segment. You can call in at 877-789-2539. That's 877-789-2539. Or if you're calling internationally, you can call in from call in at this number, 512-646-1776. That's 512-646-1776. And we'll take your calls, try to have your question ready, and we'll give you the best answer that we can. In this context, it's good to go through some additional articles and information that came out today and that has come out over the last several weeks, including this article that turned out prescient. The ban on elective procedures is killing more people than COVID-19. Just that aspect of the shutdown is killing more people than COVID-19. Indeed, as the article details, the directives on states forced them to cancel compulsory cancellation and postponement of all non-emergent medical procedures by governors and mayors across the country. As this article details, there are only 2 types of procedures, emergent and elective. So when you see the word elective, it doesn't mean optional. It means just not an emergency. Indeed, emergent procedures must be performed without delay, whereas elective procedures simply are not emergency procedures. They're all the non-emergency ones. They're not optional. It's important, as the article notes, not to conflate elective with optional. Optional procedures are like cosmetic surgery and the like are not what is at issue here. Examples of elective procedures include coronary artery bypass, pacemaker insertions, spinal fusions, cancer resections, tumor biopsies, organ donations, gallbladder and kidney stone removals, orthopedic repairs, joint replacements, blood work, diagnostic imaging, ECGs and EKGs, cardiac treatment, nerve block injections, colonoscopies, mammograms, and bone marrow transplants. These are anything but uncritical procedures. Indeed, as the American Hospital Association advised, these are often life-threatening conditions that require the treatment planned and calendared and scheduled. Right now, all across the country, and for the last month and a half or so in most of the country, people are unable to access much-needed treatment and their conditions deteriorating daily. Cancers progressing from treatable to incurable. People on dialysis awaiting transplants are going to die praying for the bans to lift. Many more will suffer and die due to a massive appointment backlog once they're able to actually try to even seek treatment. And as the article details, most tragically, in all of these categories of necessary treatment that will go missing, that of people who will suffer debilitating disability or death, there are children. Indeed, avoidable death and disability is the most likely consequence from the COVID-19 shutdown, not from the virus itself. And that is why you have articles like Science Says It's Time to Start Easing the Lockdown. As was stated over a month ago by the director of public health at Yale, who apparently just doesn't happen to be on Bill Gates's payroll, the fight against coronavirus has been worse than the disease. He forecast that would be the case due to the nature of the virus, that what was needed was the precision of a surgical strike, methodically targeted, not some broad-scale wholesale approach. For a virus caused by viral particles transmitted by coughing and sneezing in close continuous contact in confined quarters, forcing people indoors was the big problem. Going outdoors was a potential solution, and yet we've required the opposite. Indeed, immunity occurs when our immune system has developed antibodies against a germ, either naturally or as a result of a vaccine, and is fully prepared should exposure reoccur. He knows that this won't happen with the nature of the shutdown. Goes through how we should have been preferentially protecting the medically frail while allowing the rest of civil society to have their rights and the public economy protected. Another article, there is no empirical evidence for these lockdowns. As another author, Wilfred Riley, goes into great detail, demonstrating how, in fact, that study after study, survey after study, medical literature after medical literature, and, in fact, the experiment of these shutdowns proves the shutdowns are themselves counter-effective rather than impactful. By contrast, as the Spectator detailed, the Swedish experiment looks like it's paying off. Indeed, the data continues to show that as the Swedish death rate continues to decline in its growth, more so in many cases than in many other parts of the world that employed a shutdown. Nor should that be necessarily surprising. After all, it's useful to remember the swine flu of 1976, where they exaggerated the threat in order to rush a vaccine, got thousands of Americans to take it. And what happened with that rushed vaccine? Thousands of Americans suffered debilitating nerve conditions. Others died. More suffered worse conditions from the vaccine than from the flu itself that year. That is why we should not trust politicians to repeat the same pattern again or allow them to where we can effectively resist. Notably, as an article in Axios details, Trump and top aides are increasingly questioning the accuracy of the virus death toll, recognizing the game playing that is occurring facilitated by the CDC and Fauci's pals within the government, that increasingly recognizing that some of this information doesn't seem to hold true. But of course, what is Gates and team promoting? There's an article in the Dispatch talking about what if we tried a real quarantine? And what do they mean by that in part? Well, there's talk already afoot of doing a form of detention camps as a mechanism of quarantine, which, of course, is how the Germans pitched some of their concentration camps and ghettos in during World War II. When we go back to this, we increasingly find certain people at the center of it. And that includes Bill Gates and Anthony Fauci. Indeed, if we look at video, a photo clip number one, that's one of the many photos you'll find out there of a smiling Bill Gates with a smiling Anthony Fauci and their long-standing, long-term relationship. It's useful in this capacity, if we look at image number two, to remember Anthony Fauci was very proud and pleased to communicate with Cheryl Mills on behalf of the Clinton team about how wonderful Hillary Clinton was. That's his political background, political profile. We look at photo image number three. We see Fauci in the left with a wide range of people, including George Soros and others, as part of a sort of continued political group to push vaccines on the world, which Fauci and Gates have been instrumental in pushing and propagating across the country. Indeed, that is why the article that was broadcast in Politico, published in Politico, back in 2017, when whistleblowers came forward and talked about, the headline of the article would be, "Meet the world's most powerful doctor, Bill Gates." And indeed, the article goes into detail describing how much influence Bill Gates has. They even described him as, quote, monopolistic in his control of philanthropy, much as he engaged in illicitly that led to antitrust investigations and inquiries back in the 90s and early 2000s related to his role in Microsoft. Indeed, they refer to it as, quote, the Bill Chill, how he controls and dictates the outcome. Indeed, he is, according to this one representative in public health, quote, Bill Gates is treated like a head of state around the world, at key, not only in key national health organizations, but by the World Health Organization and by others. They note their concern that he is often a Trojan horse for corporate interests to undermine, in fact, public interest in different parts of the world and the globe. And they express particular concern that his focus was going to debilitate the ability of governments to, quote, support their health systems if the next epidemic hits. Was that coincidental and accidental? That's an open question yet to be decided and resolved, given that we're instituting shutdown policies that are causing the deaths that supposedly they're intended to prevent and preclude. In that capacity, we should look at a recent whistleblower who has come out and described some of the issues that she had historically with Mr. Fauci related to HIV. Indeed, if you dig into HIV, where Fauci made his name to fame, you find a wide range of questionable behaviors and activities. So let's take a look at part of this whistleblower interview that was recently broadcast. Let's take a look at video clip number five.
Dr. Judy Mikovits has been called one of the most accomplished scientists of her generation. Her 1991 doctoral thesis revolutionized the treatment of HIV/AIDS. At the height of her career, Dr. Mikovits published a blockbuster article in the journal Science. The controversial article sent shockwaves through the scientific community as it revealed that the common use of animal and human fetal tissues were unleashing devastating plagues of chronic diseases. For exposing their deadly secrets, the minions of Big Pharma waged war on Dr. Mikovits, destroying her good name, career, and personal life. Now, as the fate of nations hang in the balance, Dr. Mikovits is naming names of those behind the plague of corruption that places all human life in danger. So you made a discovery that conflicted with the agreed-upon narrative.
Correct.
And for that, they did everything in their powers to destroy your life.
Correct.
You were arrested.
Correct.
And then you were put under a gag order.
For 5 years, if I went on social media, if I said anything at all, they would find new evidence and put me back in jail. And it was one of the few times I cried, and it was because I knew there was no evidence the first time. And when you can unleash that kind of force to force someone into bankruptcy with a perfect credit score, and so that I couldn't bring my 97 witnesses, which included the heads, Tony Fauci, you know, Ian Lipkin, the heads of the public health and HHS, who would have had to testify that we did absolutely nothing wrong.
And so what did they charge you with?
Nothing.
But you were in jail.
I was held in jail with no charges. I was called a fugitive from justice. no warrant, literally drugged me out of the house. Our neighbors are looking at what's going on here. You know, they searched my house without a warrant, literally terrorized my husband for 5 days. They said, if you don't find the notebooks, if you don't find the material, which was not in my possession, but planted in my house.
As if you took intellectual property from the laboratory. Is
yes.
that correct?
It was intended to appear as if I took confidential material, names, and intellectual property from the laboratory. And I could prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that I didn't. Heads of our entire HHS colluded and destroyed my reputation, and the Department of Justice and the FBI sat on it and kept that case under seal, which means you can't say there's a case or your lawyers are held in contempt of court. So you can't even get a lawyer to defend you. So every single due process right was taken away from me, and to this day remains the same. I have no constitutional freedoms or rights.
Yet you sit here. I think a lot of people would probably have just taken the retirement out early, laid low, but you have decided to come forth when your gag order has been released to write a book called Plague of Corruption, Restoring Faith in the Promise of Science, and you are naming names.
Absolutely.
Apparently, their attempt to silence you has failed. And I have to ask, how do you sit here with confidence to call out these great forces and not fear for your life as you leave this building?
Because if we don't stop this now, we can not only forget our republic and our freedom, but we can forget humanity because we'll be killed by this agenda.
So, Anthony Fauci.
My name is Dr. Tony Fauci. I'm the director of the...
The man who is heading the pandemic task force was involved in a cover-up.
He directed the cover-up. And in fact, everybody else was paid off. And paid off big time. Millions of dollars in funding from Tony Fauci, Tony Fauci's organization, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease. These investigators that committed the fraud continue to this day to be paid big time by the NIAID.
And the whole world is listening to his advice for how to handle this current pandemic. How do we know that what he's saying is what we need to be learning?
What he's saying is absolute propaganda, and the same kind of propaganda that he's perpetrated to kill millions since 1984.
We know from this study quite clearly that there will be a delay in progression significantly greater than for individuals who do not take the drug.
It started really when I was 25 years old. I was part of the team that isolated HIV from the saliva and blood of the patients from France, where Luc Montagnier had originally isolated the virus. This was a confirmatory study, but Tony Fauci and Robert Gallo were working together then to spin the story in a different way. At that time, Dr. Rossetti was out of town, and Tony Fauci says, you know, we understand that you have a paper in press, and we want a copy of it. And I said, yes, there's a paper in press, and it's confidential, and no, I will not give you a copy of it. He started screaming at me, then he said, give us the paper right now, or you'll be fired for insubordination. And I just said, I'm sure when Dr. Rossetti gets back, you can have the conversation. And so Frank comes back, you know, several weeks later, and is really bullied into giving Fauci the paper. Fauci holds up the publication of the paper for several months, while Robert Gallo writes his own paper and takes all the credit, and of course patents are involved. This delay of the confirmation, you know, literally led to spreading the virus around, you know, killing millions.
Perhaps no one expressed the anguish of AIDS better than New York writer Larry Kramer. But he was even more angry at the federal government and the pharmaceutical industry. One person who felt Kramer's fury was NIH Dr. Anthony Fauci.
He called Tony Fauci the Bernie Madoff of science. It's still been crushing to me to think that I didn't know my work in 1999 was something that had been avoided. From 83 and 82, when the virus was isolated, the virus didn't have to wait until 84 to be confirmed. Think of how many people, the entire continent of Africa, you know, lost a generation as that virus was spread through because of the arrogance of a group of people. And it includes Robert Redfield, who's now the head of the CDC. Right along with Tony Fauci. They were working together to take credit and make money, and they had the patents on it and tailored them to IL-2 therapy, which was absolutely the wrong therapy. And had that not happened, millions wouldn't have died from HIV.
How can a man who's giving, any person who's giving global advice for health own a patent in the solution in the vaccine? Isn't that a conflict of interest, or shouldn't it be?
It is a conflict of interest. And in fact, this is one of the things that I've been saying and would like to say to President Trump: repeal the Bayh-Dole Act.
Bayh-Dole fundamentally changed the way universities approach technology transfer. And you can see that best in the statistics. Universities obtain 16 times as many patents today as they did in 1980. Now, everybody's getting more patents, but still, universities' share of all patents in the United States is more than 5 times greater than it was before Bayh-Dole. The situation has gotten so bad that one information technology industry official has publicly referred to universities as, quote, crack addicts, unquote, driven by, quote, small-minded tech transfer offices addicted to patent royalties.
That act gave government workers the right to patent their discoveries. So to claim intellectual property for discoveries that the taxpayer paid for. Ever since that happened in the early 80s, it destroyed science. And this allowed the development of those conflicts of interest. And this is the crime behind letting somebody like Bill Gates, with billions of dollars — nobody elected him, he has no medical background, he has no expertise — but we let people like that have a voice in this country while we destroy the lives of millions of people.
Normalcy only returns when we've largely vaccinated the entire global population.
If we activate mandatory vaccines globally, I imagine these people stand to make hundreds of billions of dollars that own the vaccines.
And they'll kill millions, as they already have with their vaccines. There is no vaccine currently on the schedule for any RNA virus that works.
So I have to ask you, are you anti-vaccine?
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, vaccine is immune therapy, just like interferon alpha is immune therapy. So I'm not anti-vaccine. My job is to develop immune therapies. That's what vaccines are.
Do you believe that this virus was created in a laboratory?
I wouldn't use the word created, but you can't say naturally occurring if it was by way of the laboratory. So it's very clear.
So there you have a whistleblower describing Anthony Fauci as the Bernie Madoff of science. Is he? Well, that'll be something we'll be exploring in more detail in the shows to come. Now let's go to your calls, as you get to participate in this program as part of the jury in a way that you haven't got a chance to participate in many of the public policies being unilaterally declared like royal edicts by various politicians across the world. Let's go to Dennis in Virginia.
Hey, Mr. Barnes, great program this evening. I'm a retired Army guy, and I tell you what really bothers me most about this is I can't count on my hands the guys I knew killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it makes me sick to see the condition our country is in today. I mean, is this the country they died for? You know, as a military guy, we took an oath to defend the Constitution of the United States, you know, from enemies, foreign and domestic. There's a lot of domestic enemies trying to do this country in. And when I see people being beat down, smacked down, dragged off to jail, ticketed, it makes me sick. As a military guy, a veteran, it makes me sick. So where do we draw the line?
There's no doubt about it. The line needs to and must be drawn. And as we saw from the police officer who risked his own profession and career by going viral with his video earlier today, talking about the necessity and a call to his fellow officers, uphold your oath. Your oath is to the Constitution. It ain't to a local politician. It isn't to Governor Grusom. It isn't to Mayor de Stasio. It isn't to any of these folks. The oath is to the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the state where they serve. It is not to a politician. It is not to Bill Gates. It's not to Anthony Fauci. It's not to the National Institutes for Health or Big Pharma. It is solely and wholly to the American people, to the citizens of the state and country where they live and reside, and their willingness to recognize what Gretchen Smith talked about earlier, the willingness to refuse to obey an unlawful order, an unconstitutional order. It is the key and it is the core. Not only do we need people in willingness to risk their own liberty and freedom by resisting any unlawful order, unconstitutional order in their own civil disobedience, much as Martin Luther King built the civil rights movement based on willingness to violate orders that violated the Constitution, because that is the ultimate authority. An unlawful order, an unconstitutional order, has no legal authority. That's what the judge said in the quarantine case in 1856, when he said and well articulated that an order that is unconstitutional, disobeying it cannot be a crime and require the person to be discharged. Indeed, today, the Texas Attorney General and Texas Governor condemned the judge in Dallas who tried to sentence someone to 7 days simply for opening up their hair salon. More and more people are being woken up. And in the same context, we need our judges to wake up. We need our public officials to wake up. More and more ordinary police officers are waking up. More and more military officers are waking up. More and more public health official whistleblowers are waking up. And more of the public is waking up, not only in public protest, but in public participation in protests that are critical, essential, and fundamental to restoring American liberty. Effectively, we need a renewal of the American Revolution of 1776. As the old statement goes, the best answer to 1984 is more 1776. That's what we need today, because what is essential is our core constitutional liberties. And who is essential is every American alive today. You are essential. Our core liberties are essential, but we have to once again fight for them to restore them and keep them free. We need to make America, America again. So do your part by sharing links to this show, by sharing public participation, by engaging your politicians in every way you can legally and properly to keep and restore our freedoms so that America will be America again.